Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Art Cullen will be here. I'll talk with him about his new short documentary, Last Man Standing, a cross-country quest to understand climate change. But first, in 2021, journalist Chloe Angel published Turning Point, How a New Generation of Dancers is Saving Ballet from Itself. It is an in-depth exploration of ballet, particularly professional ballet, and the institutional and cultural problems that plague it. Now she has published a steamy romance novel that takes place in the world of professional ballet. It's called Pas de Don't, and it takes place in New York City and Sydney, Australia, Angel's hometown. Heather Hayes is a principal dancer at the New York Ballet who is nursing a broken heart. She gets hired as a guest artist with the Australian National Ballet, where she meets Marcus Campbell, a dancer who is recovering from a devastating injury and working through grief. When they meet, there's instant chemistry, but the Australian National Ballet has a very strict no dating policy. These days, Chloe Angel lives in Coralville, Iowa, and she is with me now. Hello, Chloe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you back. And I think the very best way to start would be to read just a short excerpt from your novel. And of course, what is a romance novel without a meet cute? That's where we start, right?
Let's do it. Text from Devo, 6:12 a.m. Call me when you wake up. Marcus rolled groggily out of bed and walked the short distance to the kitchen where the coffee machine was already gurgling. His stomach clenched with anxiety as he dialed his brother's number. Hey, Devo answered brusquely. You rang? Yeah, I did. Listen, Devo said in his usual stern and serious tone. Marcus could picture him stepping out of whatever house he and his crew were working on, maybe slipping into the back garden for some privacy. I'm going over to Mum's for dinner Sunday night. You should come too. We can try again. Marcus leaned against the counter and sighed. Since their dad had died, this was the only thing Devo wanted to talk about with him, his campaign to convince their mum she should sell the family home and downsize. Don't you think she's got a point? He asked cautiously. Yeah, the place is getting to be too much for her, but she doesn't have to move out right away. We could hire a cleaner or something. Devo tisked impatiently, and Marcus heard his brother's Kelpie banjo bark in the background. That's just a short-term solution. And it's not just the upkeep, it's the stairs too. They're really steep, and there's no bathroom downstairs, so she's got to go up and down all day. Marcus sighed again. Solving that problem would be much more expensive than hiring a cleaner. He thought about the little brick house where he and Devo had grown up. The Campbells' home was small, especially compared to the luxury homes that started springing up on the northern beaches in the last decade, as even people with plenty of money started getting pushed into middle-class suburbs. Still, Marcus had had a hard time getting up those stairs on crutches, and his mum's osteoarthritis wasn't getting any better. He and Devo had both noticed it was getting harder for her to get around the house and to keep the place in decent nick. And now that his dad was gone, I just don't want to rush her, Marcus said, determined to stop his thoughts drifting in that direction. She's had a hard year, like the rest of us, and moving is really stressful. Yeah, but the market's having a great year, so if she moves fast, she can get a really good price. Marcus tried not to think about what modern monstrosity a new owner would inevitably build once they bought his childhood home and knocked it down. There was no stopping Devo once he got an idea in his head, but Marcus really wished he would be a little less terse with their mum as he was shooing her out the door of her own house. The last time he'd brought this up with her, she'd nearly burst into tears. Marcus couldn't let his brother go over there on his own. I'll be there Sunday, but I need to get out of the door now. I'll text you. Yep, see ya, Devo said quickly and hung up. An hour later, Marcus crutched his way down the central hallway at A&B. For what felt like the thousandth time, he bypassed the studios for the physio room, where Sharon was finishing up with another dancer. Pausing in the doorway, he called, I'm here, I'm just going to go change. Down at the end of the hallway, Marcus shouldered his way into the men's locker room. After yesterday's session, Sharon had been satisfied that he was ready to practice walking and pliés again today. Finally, he was moving in the right direction. He sat on one of the locker room benches and carefully unwrapped his boot. He slid out of his jeans and gently worked his left foot into a pair of navy tracksuit pants. He just slid his right foot in and stood up to pull them on when he heard the door swing open behind him, followed by a loud gasp. "Oh my God," a woman exclaimed as he whipped his head around. "I'm so sorry. I thought this was the women's locker room." He hastily pulled his pants over his crotch, then turned around to face her, too intrigued to be embarrassed. But she had turned back towards the door and had her hands over her eyes, which seemed a little redundant to him. "You can turn around," he said, amused. "I'm fully clothed now."
That is just a little bit of the romance novel Pas de Don't by Chloe Angel. And I mentioned that you wrote a couple of years ago, you published Turning Point, How a New Generation of Dancers is Saving Ballet from Itself. I really found reading both books that they were really in conversation with each other. In many ways, you were able to point out a lot of the problems in the world of ballet in this novel, but also create a little bit of a utopian environment where you fix a lot of those problems. Tell me how you thought about writing this book.
Like you, I think I read a lot of historical romance novels. Even though I write contemporary, I read a lot of historicals. And one of the things I really love about historical romance authors is how much research goes into one of those books when it's done right. You know, you read a historical and you know the author knows what these people eat and drink and wear and smoke and what all the social mores are of the world that they're in. And as I started writing Pas de Don't, I thought, I have already done a whole nonfiction book's worth of research. So I think I can pour a lot of this reporting into the novel in a different format. And I didn't want to create a utopian ballet company. I wanted to make the point that progress is complicated. It takes time, it takes intention, it takes planning. And I didn't want to skip the bit where the Australian National Ballet has solved all of the giant cultural systemic problems of ballet, and we didn't get to see that part. And so you have two ballet companies in this book. One is in New York and is very old school and entrenched in some pretty harmful practices. And the other is trying in a well-intentioned but not always effective way to solve some of those problems. It's not a utopia because Australia is not a utopia. It's a real place. And I wanted to be true to the pace, the likely pace of progress in ballet.
But there are many of the things that are being put into place in this Australian National Ballet that you write about that are actions that you would promote or that you would argue for in ballet.
Yes, absolutely. I think prioritizing mental health care and allowing dancers to wear tights and pointe shoes that match their skin tone, not policing how they wear their hair, allowing dancers to take on leadership roles within the company before they retire so that they have some sense of life after dancing. I would not advise a non-fraternization policy, which is the central tension at the heart of this book, at least not as a means of preventing sexual harassment, because as the book spends several hundred pages pointing out, badly designed policies have real human costs.
Although you really, really needed that non-fraternization policy as an author to create a lot of tension.
You got to have external barriers. You got to have some reason to keep these two people who are wildly attracted to each other from acting on that attraction.
So tell me a little bit about your relationship with romance, because, I mean, you even studied as a scholar. You studied romantic comedies, right?
Yes. My PhD is in media studies, and I wrote my dissertation about Hollywood romantic comedies.
Where did this start for you?
Right where Fräulein Maria says at the very beginning. I think I have always loved, I've always loved love stories. I mean, most people love stories. And even though I recognized as I came into more of a feminist worldview that a lot of those love stories were telling just one version of what love and a happy ending looks like. But I really became a devoted romance reader in 2017 or 2018. I was covering breaking news in the first year of the Trump administration, and romance novels really became a way for me to not turn off my brain at the end of the day, but turn my brain to something joyful and hopeful with a guaranteed happy ending. which was something that was in pretty short supply in 2017.
So you came to romance novels kind of late, considering how early you came to romantic comedies.
Yes.
Was there something preventing you from reading romance novels?
Honestly, I think no one had ever put one in front of me. I think if someone had, you know, put in my hands the book that landed in my hands in 2017 or 2018 and said, read this, I would have become hooked on romance a lot earlier. But this book showed up at my desk one day in the newsroom and I read it. And then I did what I think a lot of romance readers do, which is I quickly consumed everything this author had ever written. The author, by the way, is Alyssa Cole. The book is A Princess in Theory. If you would like to fall down a rabbit hole, it's a great place. It's a great rabbit hole to fall down.
So you and I have talked not very long ago about modern romance novels, because if your idea of romance novels is stuck in the 1980s, things are very, very different in the world of romance now. And we talked about some of the problems with romance novels, some of the tropes that get overused, some of the just the tools that romance novelists use that frustrate you. So having been a vocal critic of romance novels, tell me about the pressure that you were feeling writing your own romance novel.
I wouldn't say I'm a vocal critic of romance novels. I'm like we discussed, I'm new to the genre, but I have spent, you know, the last 10 years of my writing career writing about gender and power and the stories that we tell about them and how those stories, especially romantic stories, often do women, and in many cases, masculinity, a disservice. And so, yeah, there was a lot of pressure to get this right. But there was also a lot of pressure to tell a story about ballet that wasn't glamorizing pain or sort of fetishizing the bodies casually depicting disordered eating in a way that's very, very common in media about ballet. And so, you know, trying to write a feminist ballet romance novel that treats ballet the same way Turning Point treated it, which is it's a job. These are workers. You know, they happen to be wearing leotards and point shoes and dancing all day, but they're doing a job. And at the heart of this book is a workplace policy that does not serve the workers in that workplace.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Chloe Angel. She is the author of a new romance novel. It's called Pas de Don't. And she'll be at Sidekick Coffee and Books in Iowa City on June 9th at 7 p.m. in conversation with Denise Williams. Also, I mentioned her nonfiction book, Turning Point. That's coming out in paperback in July. More in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I will talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Art Cullen about his new short documentary. It's called Last Man Standing, A Cross-Country Quest to Understand Climate Change. Right now, though, I'm talking about romance with author Chloe Angel. She has just published her very first novel. It is a romance novel that takes place in the world of professional ballet. It's called Pas de Don't. She is a journalist. She's also written a nonfiction book about the world of professional ballet called Turning Point, How a New Generation of Dancers is Saving Ballet from Itself, that's coming out in paperback in July. And Chloe, just before the break, we were talking about writing a romance novel that avoids some of the tropes, some of the pitfalls that maybe are not original or not as interesting as a romance novel can be. So when you sat down to write this novel or to plan it out, did you have a list of things that you were like, I will not have fake dating. I will not have... other tropes are not springing to my mind. But...
I didn't, but I want to be very clear. Among romance readers, I am in the minority in not enjoying fake dating. It's wildly popular.
It's very common.
And when it's done well, it's fantastic and I enjoy it.
Far more common in romance than in real life. There are so few opportunities to fake date in real life.
And the world is poorer for it. Every romance contains tropes, and you have sort of the big ones, the big structural ones like forbidden romance, which is the sort of overarching trope that guides this book. And then you have sort of micro tropes. One of my favorites is only one bed. It's when, you know, two people who definitely don't want to spend the night together show up to a hotel and there's only one room and there's only one bed and everyone's horribly appalled but turn out to be fine with it. Fantastic micro trope. I knew that I wanted this to be a forbidden romance because I wanted to explore what does a post Me Too movement workplace romance look like? How can it be done ethically, safely, legally? How do we, especially in an industry that has been rife with sexual harassment basically since its inception, but has particularly gotten a lot of publicity in the last few years for sexual harassment, what does dating and falling in love look like in this world? In this all-consuming career where you really don't have a lot of time to go meet people who are not in the same line of work as you are.
Well, and it did make me think in reading this book, I'm like, gosh, why aren't more romance novels set in the world of ballet with all of these young, incredibly physically fit people in close proximity to each other? That seems like really a perfect
and there are lots of them. This is certainly not the first one. There are lots of them, contemporaries and historicals. But I wanted to... There's also a lot of ballet media that is about much younger people, and I wanted to write about characters who are in their late 20s, early 30s, both at the height of their careers and also like peeking out over the cliff of retirement at age 32.
Right, right. So Heather Hayes is the heroine in your book, and she is a principal dancer in New York City. She's also a survivor of a really coercive and emotionally abusive relationship. And you work really hard to portray what she has gone through and how it affects her. Tell me about why that was important for you to write.
I think the conversation about emotional abuse and coercive control has gotten a lot sort of louder and more nuanced in the last couple of years. We've got lots of songs about it, books about it, movies about it, and I think more and more people are coming to the realization that they or people around them are or have been in profoundly unhealthy and damaging relationships. And this book is in part about learning to see yourself clearly after a relationship like that has really warped your self-image, and how to find yourself, even if that means running away to the other side of the world.
Marcus Campbell is recovering from a terrible injury that he sustained while on stage dancing in front of an audience. And again, that was another moment where I felt like this book is in conversation with what I learned from reading your other book, Turning Point. This is a really common problem for people in the world of ballet, where they're performing very difficult at this incredibly high level and devastating injuries are common.
Yes, although there's less about that in this book than there was before my editor got her hands on it. There was a whole passage about how this is the most common kind of ballet injury, and it's more common in men than it is in women because of the jumps. And my editor was like, Chloe, this is a romance novel.
Stop.
We don't need stats.
Like, but this is very important for people to know about.
Yes.
Well, he also reflects on the life growing up as a boy and a man in the world of ballet.
Yeah, I mean, boys who dance are bullied at really, really high rates. And I think his experience is pretty minimal compared to what a lot of people go through. I don't think you can talk about men in ballet and specifically the dominant version of masculinity in Australia growing up in the 80s and 90s without it seemed to be wildly unrealistic to write a character who had grown up dancing in Australia in the 80s and 90s and not been bullied for it. I mean, it's a romance novel, but I wasn't going to ask readers to suspend disbelief quite that much.
So speaking of Australia, you take us across the world to Sydney, Australia, which is your hometown. Mm-hmm. Tell me what it was like to write about Sydney, especially having lived away from it for so long.
I started writing this book in May 2020. So because of the pandemic, Australia's borders had been closed for a couple of months at that point, and it was not clear to me when I was going to get to go home again. So I was very homesick and also hadn't seen live dance or gone to a dance class in a couple of months and starting to really be homesick for that place as well. And so I decided to write about it. And it immediately became clear to me that the best way to write about Australia is to bring a non-Australian there and have them be shown around and have them experience this new place and sort of feel like a stranger in a strange land a little bit. It was pretty easy to write. I mean, I know I haven't lived in Sydney for 17 years at this point, but I visit often enough and I know the place well enough that I knew exactly where I wanted to take these characters and what those places were going to smell like and taste like and sound like. And I did feel a lot of pressure to get that part right, though, because I wanted, well, two things. One, like I said earlier, Australia isn't a utopia, and I didn't want Heather and Marcus running around my hometown like it was an amusement park. Like, it's not a perfect place. Australia is sexist and racist and has all kinds of problems. And Sydney has a massive gentrification problem that is making the real estate market a nightmare, which is a subplot in this book. Because who doesn't love a good gentrification subplot in their escapist novels? I didn't want Australians to read this book and feel like it had been written by an outsider who was idealizing the place that they live, because I'm Australian and I wanted to make the place look beautiful and realistic.
In your acknowledgments at the end of the book, you thank your parents and say that they're forbidden to read this book. But were there a lot of phone calls home asking, like, hey, does this ring true?
So it's not so much that they're not allowed to read it. It's that
they're not allowed to tell you they've read it.
In keeping with the theme of policies that don't work, I have enacted a don't ask, don't tell policy. No, I mean, there were a couple of moments in copy editing where the American copy editor flagged a phrase and I had to take it to my dad and be like, hey, does this sound, the copy editor wants to change it to this. Do you think it would be weird if we went with a slightly Americanized version? So there was a couple, there was a little bit of like trans-Pacific fact checking going on.
I'm talking with Chloe Angel about her debut romance novel, Pas de Don't. And let's talk about sex, because again, last time we talked about modern romance novels, you made a very clear point that they should be hot. I think that was a quote from you.
They can be hot. Yeah. I prefer them to be hot, but there's such a broad range of heat levels available. Everything from in romance is often referred to as an open door, referring to the bedroom door. You know, sometimes the door is closed and you don't go into the bedroom with them. Sometimes the door is open, but you like stand on the threshold. And sometimes the camera like basically goes into bed with the characters. And then there are also romance novels with like almost no physical contact, you know, about religiously observant people or Amish characters where there's basically no physical touching at all. So I know where I write romance novels at the heat level that I prefer to read them, but I would say that there's a heat level for any reader who's comfortable with it.
Several years ago, I interviewed Amy Tan when her book The Valley of Amazement came out, and that was the first time that she had written sex scenes.
Wow.
And so I asked her about that, and she said, well, I never wanted to do it because when you write a sex scene, people assume that's what you are doing in your bedroom.
Sure.
And that was a book that really required it because of the people who were in the novel. So in writing sex scenes, I mean, what is going through your head? Because I can imagine that it's hard to just push the audience aside.
Yes, and especially if you imagine that audience eventually being your parents or parents-in-law, hence the don't ask, don't tell policy.
Right.
I think of sex scenes in romance novels the way I think of musical numbers in Broadway shows, which is that they should be sort of entertaining in and of themselves, but when they're done well, they tell you something about the character or characters. They move the plot forward, and they they allow the characters to learn something about themselves or about each other. And that means that, you know, there's a lot of, I always ask myself, what is this sex scene for? You know, in addition to, you know, making the characters feel good physically and making sure that the reader is having a good time, like plot-wise, character-wise, what is this sex scene for? I think we've all been, like, those of us who watch musicals have all sat through a musical where you can tell that the producers were just like, oh no, it's been 15 minutes since we last did a song. Let's plug a song in here. And there are definitely romance novels that have sex scenes that are just like dropped in because it's been 50 pages since we last had one. But I think when it's done well, it moves the story and the characters forward in addition to them having a great time. Or not. I mean, bad sex scenes can, you know, can move the plot and the characters forward too.
I want to ask you, I mean, speaking of the audience, you are a fairly high-profile person in the state of Iowa because you are married to State Senator Zach Walls. Does that make writing a romance novel trickier in some ways, knowing that there are eyes upon you?
I mean, Zach has never been anything other than wildly supportive of this project. And one thing that I always remind myself is that this is an adult book about adults falling in love and having hot, consensual, mutually enjoyable sex. And, you know, if there are any politicians of any political stripe who have a problem with adults falling in love and having hot, consensual, mutually enjoyable sex, I think they will find themselves wildly out of step with not just most voters, but like most breathing adults.
I can imagine, because of who you are and the social circle that you are part of, that there are probably a lot of people who will pick this book up and read it because they know Chloe and they want to read it, but it may be their very first romance novel. Is that something that you've already experienced, people reading their first romance novel because you wrote it?
Yes. And that's a huge amount of pressure, by the way. But I also hope that it gives them enough of a taste of the genre that they want to read more, because it's such a big genre. If you know where to look, it can be really diverse, not just in terms of who's writing, but in what kinds of stories they're writing. And, you know, I firmly believe there's a romance book for everyone. And if this is people's first, I just hope it's not their last.
Speaking of how most people or many people respond to romance, if they read a romance novel and they like it, then they want to consume no more. And the audience for romance novels is incredibly hungry and I think demanding.
Voracious.
And a lot of successful romance novels or novelists are incredibly prolific because of that hunger. But that seems like an incredible amount of pressure as well. You wrote this pretty quickly. I mean, you and I talked about your nonfiction book in 2021. Here we are talking again in 2023. How do you think about the future? You have already written a sequel?
Yes, the sequel will be out next May.
Exciting. That's very exciting. So do you feel like that is a hunger you can feed?
Well, I did write it in 2020, but I do want to remind folks that it wasn't like I was leaving the house in 2020, which was how I was able to write two books in that year.
Although that's a lot more than most of us did in 2020. So
yeah,
we're going to give you credit anyway.
Fair enough. I think one of the great things about romance being such a big active genre is that it allows you to see other romance novelists not as competitors, but as people who are actually maintaining your audience while you're off, you know, in the writing cave, not publishing anything, because there's no way that one author can feed this beast. It takes all of us. And so, I feel some pressure to write quickly, but I also know that, you know, if I'm lucky enough to develop a loyal audience, they'll wait. And in the meantime, there are so many other authors who are also publishing who they can read while they're waiting.
One of the challenges for romance novelists is that most of the time we are promised a happy ending. And that makes it hard to write a sequel, at least a sequel that includes the same characters and that relationship that people have really gotten connected to. So thinking about sequels, how does that look for you?
The next book in the series is called Point of Pride, and the main character in that one is the best friend in Pardo Don't. So that's one way to solve the sequel problem that you just described, is to make sure that you are creating a really well-developed cast of characters in each book so that any one of them, the reader would be happy to read a whole book about them. And I think the best friend in this book, Carly, is enough of a character. Some would say almost too much. She's a lot. The male main character in the next book describes her as a human hurricane. She's enough of a character that I think that I hope that readers will be happy to read her whole love story and watch her get her happy ending.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but I mean, this feels like a point of departure for you in your career. You've been a journalist for a long time and you're trying out other things. What do you think the future looks like?
It doesn't feel like a departure. You know, I studied gender studies and then I got a PhD in rom-coms and then I did journalism about ballet, and this just really feels like braiding all of those strands together and ascending into the final form I was always supposed to inhabit.
Well, it's fun to witness your ascension, Chloe. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Chloe Angel is the author of the new romance novel Pas de Don't. She'll be at Sidekick Coffee and Books in Iowa City on June 9th at 7 p.m. in conversation with Denise Williams. She's also got some other appearances in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines coming up in June. You can find out more on her website, ChloeSAngel.com. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Art Cullen is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Storm Lake Times Pilot. He won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize in editorial writing for his editorials revealing powerful corporate agricultural interests in Iowa. And since then, he's written a book, been the subject of an award-winning documentary, and he's launched a Substack newsletter called Art Cullen's Notebook. In short, he is still working incredibly hard to do what he can to reach a broader audience. He's also recently taken a road trip out west. He's written about that journey in the paper and his Substack and released a short documentary called Last Man Standing, a cross-country quest to understand climate change. Here's a moment from the film.
This drought's been going on for 20 to 30 years and could run another 20 or 30. The world's top scientists aren't certain what's just around the bend except for this. Human activity is cooking the Great Plains and Southwest.
We're sitting in the garden spot of the world in Iowa, and it made me wonder, how are they coping in the Great Plains and in the Southwest? Then we wanted to go out to the West Coast and see how people perceived the drought there. Everybody thinks they're going to be the last man standing.
Now Art Cullen is with me on the line. Hello, Art.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, wonderful to talk to you again. And I mean, Art, I see you as a man on a mission, not just to keep your paper and local journalism alive, but you really are trying to communicate with people. Can you tell me how you see your mission in life at this moment?
Oh, yeah. Like Jake and Elwood, I'm on a mission from God and the Blues Brothers. It seems to me that we're paying very little attention to the intersection between climate change and food production. And it's very frustrating from a rural perspective to see how little attention is paid to it. And there's a crisis occurring right now in cattle country from Amarillo, Texas to Nebraska, where they're running out of water. And there's this 30-year drought that's been going on, and according to the Goddard Space Institute, this drought probably could last for 50 years. And there are cattle producers steadily going broke in Kansas and Nebraska and Colorado, and nobody's paying attention to it. And so I thought, let's go put a lens on it. And that's, I guess, my mission is that there's a great environmental story about agriculture going on that's really dimly understood.
Tell me how this road trip came about.
Well, actually, I wanted to go out to Los Angeles to raise funds for the Western Iowa Journalism Foundation, which is a nonprofit designed to support independent newspapers in Western Iowa. And I saw all these airplanes were having near misses on the runways. And so I said, why would I want to fly out there? Instead, I'll just drive out. And so I decided to drive out with my buddy John Russell, who's a videographer, and take two-lane highways all the way out, avoid interstates and big cities, and just go into the towns that time forgot. And the portrait is revealing of rural poverty, and again of drought that's gripping, at least one third of the country geographically, and it's where about 40% of our beef supply comes from. Basically, these Great Plains states, and they're running out of water right now, not in the future, right now. And in fact, I just read a report last Friday from the USDA that showed that, that we're going to have the lowest percentage of wheat acres harvested since 1917. They're just abandoning the crops because they're so spindly from drought. And again, nobody's paying attention to it.
You took this trip in late March, early April, and it feels like there are always extreme things happening in weather, but you managed to pick a couple of weeks where the weather was really extreme. Tell me what you experienced.
Well, yeah, so we stop in Colby, Kansas, where they can barely grow corn anymore. They're growing corn of 20 to 30 bushels an acre now because of drought. And then you go into the mountains, and within a day of our passing through this peak, in the Rocky Mountains, there was avalanches from record snowfall, snowpack. And then there were 14 atmospheric bombs, that river bombs, they call them, that that went off over California, the entire Pacific coast, that are wreaking havoc on the coastlines. And it's all because of climate change and you know, CO2 in the atmosphere. And so it causes these extreme. So California is going from, although it's in the middle of a drought, it's also in the middle of these epic torrents of rain that come and wipe out entire, you know, infrastructures. And yet the everybody in Los Angeles is driving one person to a vehicle on packed freeways, and there's oil derricks pumping just offshore. And meantime, we're planning on a petrochemical base in Kansas, trying to grow corn when the rain won't come. And so we can see the extremes going on within a 2-week period.
Yeah. And of course, you went on this road trip to observe the world, to see what you could see. But you also wanted to make some personal connections. And you decided you wanted to try to make a connection with a rancher, with a cattleman. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah. So we, we were able to interview a Kansas State University ag economist who reviewed, in the 1800s, they considered abandoning Colby, Kansas, because its climate was so foreboding, and they'd gone through this epic drought back then. And it's only getting worse now with climate change. And so you go through these different environments, and finally we get to eastern Colorado. We're on a back road, and we're looking for a livestock auction house, a sale barn. And lo and behold, one pops up along the horizon, and we go in. They're having a horse sale. And, anybody who knows horses knows cattle, and sure as hell, there's a whole bunch of cattlemen milling around trying to sell mules and horses. And we run into this 19-year-old kid named Gene Jackson, who's a cattle producer, and he's got to sell his 10-year-old best mule, Jackie, because he can't afford to feed her anymore. Irrigated alfalfa is too expensive now. The water's too expensive. He can't feed his mule. How are you going to feed the cattle? And, you know, so you run into people like this, and it's not that hard to find them. Because last year, there were pickups lined up a mile long at sale barns in Kansas selling out cattle herds. And, you know, eventually this is creeping west to Iowa, where, you know, in 30 to 40 years, we might not be able to grow corn south of Interstate 80, according to Iowa State agronomists and climatologists. So, but it's something we haven't come to grips with as a state.
We
or
have
as a country.
Right. We have a hard time talking about it, too, because, I mean, we're all experiencing climate change, Art. And when you connect with a rancher or a farmer, they're experiencing climate change. But it is this phrase that has been so politicized that even people
right.
who are absolutely aware of what's happening don't want to call it climate change. So how do you think we have that conversation? I mean, we all need to get on the same page about this.
Yeah, and in fact, the brilliant pollster Ann Seltzer has done a lot of polling and focus group work on this and finds that, for example, Trump to Obama voters respond positively to messages about water quality, but not necessarily about climate change. Or, you know, you can talk about extreme weather or agricultural resiliency, so long as you don't use that phraseology, climate change. But this weather indeed is extreme by any standard. When California is on fire, or and then the next moment is under a flood, and or when you cannot raise corn in Kansas, that's extreme. And so I guess it's a matter of terminology and semantics. But the fact of the matter is that we're going to only be harvesting 67% of those wheat acres this year. That is an astounding number to me. Think about, let me repeat it one more time. Kansas wheat farmers are going to only harvest 67% of their crops. That's stunning.
What do you feel like you learned from this road trip? I mean, clearly this is something that you've written about a great deal in the past, and you were reading and watching all of these things happen from a distance. What did you learn from actually being there?
I guess one of the main lessons is that we all think that, you know, Gene Jackson thinks he's going to be the last cattle producer. And you know, I'm talking to a guy in California who grew up surfing at Huntington Beach and has seen everything, you know, as Joni Mitchell said, pave paradise and put up a parking lot. And he's seen it all come in, the freeways. And he thinks, I said, well, when are you going to get the hell out of here? Well, there ain't nobody leaving, you know, nobody's leaving. He said, well, they'll put up with some more wildfires and mudslides. And a lack of water, and I think I'm going to be the last community newspaper man standing.
Yeah.
So we all think we're going to survive this somehow while driving our SUV that gets 10 miles to the gallon, and it just doesn't work out that way.
It feels like Iowa is in a unique position. Maybe that's just because I'm here, Art. But, you know, we've got historically this Goldilocks climate where we're just
right.
perfect for growing stuff. And we're far away from the coasts. And we're not experiencing a lot of these. We are experiencing dramatic weather, but not maybe quite as dramatic as California, for example, in the last year.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that puts blinders on Iowans, the fact that here we are in the center of the country, and we do think we're going to be the last state standing?
Yeah, we do. But then the distinguished retired professor from Iowa State, Gene Tackley, who's a climatologist, part of a Nobel Prize-winning effort on climate modeling, He's warning that we're going to see such extended periods of 90 degree plus heat so many days in a row, and it's going to come right in the middle of corn pollination, that our corn yields could go back to 1985 levels. That is, our corn yields in northern Iowa could decline by 30% in the next few years, just because the pollination period is getting so hot. And we might, you know, it's kind of like the frog. You use the terms Goldilocks, well, or the frog in the slowly heating pot of water, and all of a sudden it's boiling, and then we wonder what happened. Well, there's people right at Iowa State University who've been warning us about this for many years, and we choose to ignore them or fire them. And Gene Tackley retired, but he's given us the warnings. The question is, are we listening when less than 1% of Buena Vista County is planted in winter cover crops, for example? It doesn't seem to me that we're really pushing the panic button by any means.
You're doing, it feels like, everything you can to get people to pay attention. What do you think could work? What do you think the tipping point could be to cross this divide and have real conversations about what's happening?
Well, first of all, that Charity Nebbe is calling. That's that's how it starts. And it has to start here in Iowa, where we recognize what we have to protect. The reason that we're still able to grow 200 bushel acre corn per acre corn and not 20 bushel per acre corn is because of our blessings, our soil depth, our soil quality. And we're sending it down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico. And the more we have that conversation on Iowa Public Radio and at public forums sponsored by people like the Practical Farmers of Iowa, the conversation is growing. The question is, are we able to adapt fast enough and get through our semantics to find real solutions that make farmers prosperous and rural communities prosperous, while at the same time coping with these tremendous climate problems that are confronting us now, not in the future?
And you feel like, even among people who recognize that climate change is a problem, you feel like there's not enough hunger for this conversation?
Well, for example, the video that we produced, which, you know, is pretty good, was rejected by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and as are a lot of columns that I write. And so you begin to ask yourself, am I just that dull? Am I just that bad? Or do they just not want to listen? And they don't get it. The Beltway doesn't get it. And New York doesn't get it. They don't realize what's going on in the Great Plains.
Well, Art Cullen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, well, thank you.
Art Cullen is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Storm Lake Times Pilot. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's just released a short documentary. It's called Last Man Standing, a cross-country quest to understand climate change. He also has a Substack newsletter called Art Cullen's Notebook. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Caitlin Troutman, Samantha McIntosh, and Danny Gear. We often get technical support from Steve Cooper. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.